Do you know anyone in prison? It wouldn't be surprising if you did, because according to the latest data, the U.S. has the sixth highest incarceration rate in the world. But more than just a domestic issue, a new book argues that the story of American prisons is inextricably linked to the expansion of American power around the globe. That book is American Purgatory: Prison Imperialism and the Rise of Mass Incarceration. And the author is Benjamin Weber, a historian who teaches African American studies at the University of California. Here he is to share five big ideas from his book.
Hi, everyone. I'm Benjamin Weber. I'm a historian, an African American studies professor at the University of California, Davis, and I'm the author of American Purgatory. And I'm really honored to share a few ideas from the book with you, which I've spent a decade researching and writing. The first two ideas have to do with time and space. They're about how far back and where we look for the root causes of mass incarceration, that overuse of imprisonment at a scale unprecedented in world history. And the third has to do with how modes of social control circulate, like a kind of boomerang, between a network of historic and contemporary Black sites. And the final two lift up lessons from racial justice movements, from people who have internationalized the freedom struggle, that may just hold some keys to liberating us all. The first idea is about mass incarceration's global reach. It's that we've largely missed the international dimensions of this crisis. And I remember when I first sat down to sift through prison records inside Bilibid Prison in Manila a decade ago. I realized right then and there how officials had turned thousands of anti-colonial fighters into outlaws in their search for a messiah capable of leading the Katipunan Brotherhood and uniting the liberation movement against U.S. colonial occupation. How they had sentenced them to slavery and involuntary servitude and forced them into hard labor all around the archipelago. The convict clause, allowing for slavery and involuntary servitude to be used as punishment for a crime, you see applied not only within U.S. borders, but any place subject to their jurisdiction. And so over successive eras of empire building, those places came to include a vast expanse of Native American land across North America, and places like Alaska, Hawaii, Puerto Rico, the Philippines, and the Panama Canal Zone. And convict labor at Parchman Farm in Mississippi looked very similar to plantation labor at the Uwahig Penal Farm in the Philippines, said to be the largest penal colony in the world by the 1920s. So whether we choose to ignore or disavow the history of American empire, the fact is that it crucially shaped the rise of the surveillance state, modern policing, and mass incarceration. The second insight comes from my search for root causes. The story of mass incarceration actually stretches back much further than we realize. You're probably familiar with the 13th Amendment, how it abolished slavery at the end of the Civil War, but it had an exception for slavery to continue to be used as punishment for a crime. And that exception actually originated much earlier with the Northwest Ordinance before the U.S. Constitution was even ratified. And it literally remains inscribed in federal and state law to this day. So as people in prison and Black studies scholars will tell you, the slave ship chaining, transporting, and profiting off Black people is actually America's archetypal prison. So for hundreds of years, policymakers have used slaves of the state to thwart freedom movements, establish racial hierarchy, and consolidate power. So while many date the rise of mass incarceration only back to the 1970s, when incarceration rates skyrocketed, its roots actually stretch back to racial slavery and colonial expansion. And that formula that slavery and involuntary servitude be used as punishment for crime may now actually be the longest lasting and farthest reaching piece of federal policy. From these first two ideas about shifting the spatial and temporal frame for how we see the history of the American prison system comes a related insight. The book shows how these policies and practices circulated through sites of empire to produce new forms of social control over a growing number of people ensnared in the domestic system, in what one theorist, Amy Césaire, called a kind of colonial boomerang. And this boomerang flew from colonial headquarters to American streets, from places like Manila, where police amassed index cards on fully three-quarters of the city's population, to New York, Chicago, and Oakland, where J. Edgar Hoover's FBI frantically tried to put down revolutionary movements and search to destroy any black messiah capable of uniting the growing rebellions, like Fred Hampton. And this kind of counterinsurgency campaign was summed up by one FBI agent's confidential letter to his director. In it, he wrote that black youth and moderates must be made to realize that if they succumb to revolutionary teaching, they will be dead revolutionaries. The Imperial Boomerang reveals how prison policy and foreign policy actually share a set of foundational theories, and how they've employed common assumptions about things like preemption and deterrence, containment and incapacitation, retribution and rehabilitation. And so these were developed by policymakers and globetrotting experts, not only within borders, but at overseas American colonies, in empire. People have always resisted state violence, of course. There's a certain relationship, a kind of historical dialectic between repression and freedom. But the fourth idea from the book is that we have something really important to learn from those who have internationalized the freedom struggle. Before she was imprisoned and escaped to Cuba, Asada Shakur stood with the Indians of all tribes during their takeover of Alcatraz, the abandoned federal prison in the San Francisco Bay. And she had studied the lessons of indigenous and Puerto Rican self-determination movements and incorporated them into her own thinking about black liberation. The Alcatraz occupation and Asada's escape became lodestones for racial justice movements precisely because they internationalized the struggle. So at the same time as it broadens how we understand the history of the prison system, the book also amplifies a rich history of black intellectuals and activists who challenged the expansion of the prison system and who offer a powerful tradition of decolonial practices we can draw on in the present. Black studies has always been a global project, and because of the way it attends to the lives of African-descended people worldwide, and the book amplifies this transnational framework for understanding the roots of the problem, how activists have challenged these oppressive systems, in order to open a wider set of solutions to them. And so the final insight from the book is about applying this anti-colonial or decolonial framework. What the long history of those who have internationalized the struggle against racist state violence discovered is that they had to go beyond the usual terms of domestic politics to find an anti-colonial analysis. And this resonated with people's experience when groups like the Black Panthers, the Brown Berets, the Young Lords began to describe their neighborhoods as suffering from a kind of colonial occupation. And it resonates today when racial justice movements have carried forward indigenous and black protest traditions that center self-determination. Today's politics is bedeviled by buzzwords. And many of those are racist dog whistles pitched at a kind of right-wing frequency. But social movements have developed a kind of shorthand, using what may seem jargony expressions sometime. And decolonization is one of these. It's been used a lot lately, but not everyone is sure exactly what it means. And decolonization is not a metaphor, as scholars Eve Tuck and Wayne Yang have shown and remind us. But keywords can help us unlock solutions to the most real and urgent social and political problems of our times. So just like we suffer from geographic blinders when it comes to the reach of massive policy problems and short-sightedness when it comes to possible solutions, we have to dig beneath those buzzwords. And when we do, we may just find that freedom is not an abstraction. As Black and Indigenous scholars and activists remind us, freedom dreams and practices are rooted in the places that we live, we build, and we dream. Our ongoing acts of placemaking, therefore, must center repair, dignity, equity, self-determination, and above all, collective care. So hey, thanks for listening. This is American Purgatory author Benjamin Weber, and I really hope you enjoy this book.
Thank you, Benjamin. That was Benjamin Weber with five big ideas from American Purgatory, Prison Imperialism and the Rise of Mass Incarceration. You might also want to check out our book bite for Barred, Why the Innocent Can't Get Out of Prison by Daniel Medwed. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.